Here is a special announcement. Today is Tuesday, and not, as is announced in today's Sunday Telegraph, Friday. And now, a repeat of last Thursday's performance of Monday Night is Music Night.
And here we are back with Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105, Community Radio in Your City, with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson. I'm reachable at RLA at momentsunderlamplight.co.uk or lamplight at cambridge105.fm, and our archives are posted at momentsunderlamplight.co.uk. You are invited to attend this evening under lamplight as we continue a little further, as promised last time, with Robert Frost's comments about the importance of dramatic voice as a standard of good writing. Here's his passage again. Everything written is as good as it is dramatic. It need not declare itself in form, but it is drama or nothing. By whom, where, and when is the question. Let's spend a minute attending more closely to what Frost is saying here. Everything written, that's a tough standard. It includes newspaper articles, business reports, viability studies, employee performance reports, annual reviews, not to mention business letters and advertisements. How can they be dramatic? It includes blogs and even our private diary entries. Last time I said this can be extended to all life being as good as it is dramatic, but let's forget that extended application this evening and just focus on everything written. Though we can also include the performance of anything written, so we include speeches, songs, radio, and television, though not impromptu chats. They're something else. But what about everything written? Well, it's as good as it is dramatic. As good as Frost is setting up a standard or criterion by which we can judge the goodness, the quality of any piece of written material. He's not setting up a scale ranging from not dramatic at all at one end to highly dramatic at the other end. Instead, he, surely with some glint in his eye, challenging us to challenge him, he sets up a choice between two options, drama or nothing. If there's no drama, there's no quality. That, as I said, is a pretty tough standard. We think of drama as a play to be performed, appearing usually on the page as a series of talks by the different characters in the play, sometimes interspersed with the playwright's stage directions and stage settings. But here, Frost is not being that strict. It need not declare itself in form, he says. That is, the written literature need not be set up explicitly as a series of speeches by different characters interacting with each other. No, drama can come in other ways too. Specifically, by looking at the dramatic context of the writing, or as Frost puts it, by whom, where, and when is the question. In other words, we see writing as the expression of a voice, speaking to us from some specific place and time. Where and when? Frost might have added, to whom, and even why. What is this voice speaking in response to? All speeches, on some level, a response to something, some other voice, some inner feeling or thought, some external stimulus. Even just saying, ouch, is a response to being injured. So to sum up Frost's comments, we judge a piece of writing by how well it conveys a human voice speaking out of some specific context. How real the voice seems, or if there are several voices in the piece, as in a narrative, how real the voices seem, especially as they interact together. Or even how these voices interact with voices in other writings. So it's not a question of how true the content is or how relevant, but rather how well it sets up a relationship, both with other voices and with us. Sometimes various pieces of writing come out of the same dramatic context, say a lover lamenting the loss of his beloved. And if the writing's any good, each new voice speaking out of this context offers us a fresh angle or new interpretation of the possibilities inherent in the situation. Here's an example. Last time, you will recall, we attended to Louis Barabbas' song Scarecrow, in which a woman speaks out from the grave, lamenting her death on the night before her wedding day, and describing the way nature has provided her with macabre but somewhat suitable wedding accessories, a willow veil and gown of long-leaf pine instead of lace, an embroidered train endowed with twines of every muted shade. Fronds of fern were flower girls, their dresses frayed, and the rice replaced with earth. And her wedding gown is now on a scarecrow in the field. She waits for winter, which of all the seasons tells the fewest lies, and the snow that will cover her grave will provide the most suitable alternative wedding gown. Last time we heard Louis Barabbas singing this song, but to give us the option of another voice performing the song, let's hear a cover version by Bridie Jackson and The Arbor. What difference does it make to hear a woman's voice here rather than a man's?
On my wedding day, the only rang one single bell, no witness came. You had me all to yourself, a willow veil and gown of long leaf pine instead of lace, embroidered train and out with twines of every muted shade. On my wedding day, fronds of fern were flower girls, their dresses frayed, and the rice replaced with earth. Love was my only journey till the dark swallowed me whole. Now no one will return me to your door. On my wedding day, limbs of trees strained to see, forget me not. Of all the seasons, winter always tells the fewest lies, and on snowy days and slowly fading folds of bright and white. Can a love start in a bundle's heart? Can it shelter my life in its shade? Will no one tell me why I was fated to die on the night before on my wedding night? On a scarecrow in a field, won't you take it down and lay it by my grave concealed? Of all the seasons, winter always tells. don't tell me why I was fated to die on the night before. Can a love start in a bloodless heart and shelter my life in its shade? Will no one tell me why I was fated to die on the night before my wedding day?
What does that extra voice at the end, the desolate voice of barren nature, what does that add to the drama of the song? Well, that was Bridie Jackson and the Arbor singing Louis Barabbas' song Scarecrow. Look at the fascinating video accompanying this song on YouTube. Looking under Bridie and Scarecrow will get you there. The video was directed by none other than Andrew Abbey, our Liverpool connection. Does the song meet Robert Frost's criteria for drama? By whom, when, and where? Yes, we know whose voice this is, that dead woman speaking from the grave sometime after her death and her scheduled wedding day, a long enough time, I suppose, for the people at home to turn the wedding dress into dressing for the scarecrow. And it feels like there is something almost hypnotic about the song, as though this is a recital of her woes that she repeats often. Whom is she speaking to? Or is she just talking to herself? The song does not resolve these questions, which does not make it a weaker poem, but a stronger one, offering us several possibilities, just like any human situation. But now, let's attend to another voice from the grave. This comes from one of my favorite border ballads, Clark Saunders and May Margaret. Clark Saunders was an earl's son, and Margaret was a king's daughter. And deep and heavy was the love that fell their twa between, that fell between those two. Their love led them, with some contrivance, into bed together, where at night they were discovered asleep by Margaret's seven brothers. There's a little drama as one brother after the other comments on seeing the two lovers asleep in each other's arms. The eldest wants to kill Clark Saunders, but the next brother has pity. His father has no one but he. And the next brother is even more pitying. They are in love. And the next brother adds that they've been in love many a year now. So it's no casual one-night stand. The fifth brother says it would be a sin to separate two true lovers. The sixth brother adds that it would be a shame to kill a sleeping man. You bet it would. But then the seventh son, the youngest presumably and the most impetuous, he doesn't say a word but just plunges his sword right through Clark Saunders' body. In the morning, Margaret wakes and nudges her lover, telling him it's time he was off. But she gets no answer, and dull and drumly, we might say dull and muddy, are his eyes. In typical fashion for these Scottish ballads, there is a rapid shift of scene. The body has been laid in the grave, and an hour before dawn, Clark Saunders appears at May Margaret's window. He asks her to return the pledge of love he had given her. He swore to love only her, and presumably this also has bound her to love only him. But in his generous love, he wants to free her from this commitment, so that she will not spend the rest of her days lamenting his death, but instead try to find some happiness with someone else. Margaret, however, has a demand to make before she grants this request. She's feisty, like most of the women in these ballads, and she tells Clark Saunders that she'll never give him back his faith and troth until he should come into her bedroom and kiss me cheek and chin. And now here's the gruesome voice of the grave speaking. "My mouth, it is full cold, Margaret," he says. It has the smell now of the ground, and if I kiss thy comely mouth, thy days of life will not be long. He then hears the cock crowing. It's almost daybreak, he has to get away. Give me my faith and troth again, and let me fare me on my way. But again she sets a condition. She'll not return the faith and troth until he tells her what becomes of women who die in strong travelling, that is, who die while in labour. Does she know she's pregnant, and does she have a foreboding that she'll die while giving birth? Or is she so woebegone that she feels she'll just die of grief? Travail can mean travel, but also troubles and also labour pains. He tells her that these women go to heaven and sit at the foot of our good Lord's knee in sweet company. And then she gives him back his troth with a kind of magic ritual I won't explain here, except to say that she transfers her oath onto a crystal wand and passes it to him through the window. "I thank ye, Margaret, I thank ye, Margaret," he says, "and I thank ye heartily. If ever the dead come for the quick, that is, for the living, be sure, Margaret, I'll come for thee." And his ghost disappears. But not before Margaret has hastily gotten dressed, climbs the wall, and follows him into a forest, where she loses sight of him, but finds him at his own graveside. She stands there at his grave, begging to come lie with him there. These are wonderful lines and really show the power of simple ballad style, with its repetitions and its willingness to face up to the most gruesome details without sensationalism. She pleads, "Is there any room at your head, Saunders? Is there any room at your feet? Is there any room at your side, Saunders, where fain I would sleep?" And he replies, "There's nae room at my head, Margaret. There's nae room at my feet. My bed, it is full lowly now. Amang the hungry worms I sleep. Cold mould is my covering now, but in my winding sheet. The dew, it falls nae sooner down than my resting place is wheat. But plait the wand o' bonny birk and lay it on my breast, and shed a tear upon my grave, and wish my soul good rest. And fair Margaret, and rare Margaret, and Margaret o' verity, if ever ye love another man, ne'er love him as ye did me." And then it's dawn, the ghost vanishes, and she walks slowly away weeping. I've given you a taste of the poetry, but here I want you to listen to C.R.M. Brooks reading or reciting the final lines of dialogue between the two lovers. Attend to this.
"And Clark Saunders stood at May Margaret's window, I wot an hour afore the day. 'Are you sleeping, Margaret?' he says, 'or are you waking presently? Give me my faith and troth again, I wot true love I give to thee. Your faith and troth ye never shall get, nor our true love shall never twin, until ye come within my bower and kiss me cheek and chin. My mouth, it is full cold, Margaret, it has the smell now of the ground, and if I kiss thy comely mouth, thy days of life will not be long. Oh, cocks are crowing a merry midnight, I wot the wild fowl are boding day. Give me my faith and troth again, and let me fare me on my way. My faith and troth thou shall na get, and our true love shall never twin, until ye tell what comes of women, I wot who die in strong travelling. Their beds are made in the heavens high, down at the foot of our good Lord's knee. We'll set about with jelly flowers, I wot sweet company for to see. Oh, cocks are crowing a merry midnight, I wot the wild fowl are boding day. The psalms of heaven will soon be sung, and I ere now will be missed away. Then she has ta'en a crystal wand, and she has stroken her troth thereon. She has given it him out at the shot window, with many a sad sigh and heavy groan. I thank you, Margaret. I thank you, Margaret. And I thank you heartily. Gin ever the dead come for the quick, be sure, Margaret, I'll come for thee. It's hosen and shoon and gown alone. She climbed the wall and followed him until she came to the green forest, and there she lost the sight of him. Is there only room at your head, Saunders? Is there only room at your feet? Or only room at your side, Saunders, where fain, fain I would sleep? There's nae room at my head, Margaret. There's nae room at my feet. My bed, it is full lowly now, among the hungry worms asleep. Cold mould is my covering now, but on my winding sheet. The dew, it falls nae sooner down than my resting place is weet. But plait a wand o' bonny bark and lay it on my breast, and shed a tear upon my grave, and wish my soul good rest. And fair Margaret, and rare Margaret, and Margaret o' verity, gin ever ye love another man, ne'er love him as ye did me. Then up and crew the milk-white cock, and up and crew the grey. Her lover vanished in the air, and she gaed weeping away.
That was Janet Harbison on the harp, following C.R.M. Brooks' reading of Clark Saunders and May Margaret, with part of an Irish rather than Scottish tune, Lamentation of Egan Roe O'Neill. So, there we had two voices speaking from the world of the dead. Are they as good as they are dramatic, as Frost would say? In other words, does much of their power come from the dramatic situation they are speaking out of? Yes, I think so. But bringing these two together can reveal other things about them. I noticed, for instance, that the speaker in Scarecrow seems concerned only with herself. There is, in fact, no mention of her betrothed except to say that there were no witnesses, only you, presumably the groom. Is she speaking to him? It doesn't feel like it. Not in the kind of intimate way Clark Saunders speaks to May Margaret. She seems totally wrapped up in herself, which perhaps is appropriate for someone boxed in a grave. Clark Saunders, on the other hand, is not boxed in, but his spirit arises from the grave to seek out his beloved, May Margaret. In fact, he endangers himself by staying out so long, almost getting caught by the fatal daybreak. Why? Because even in death, his love for her is so strong that he wants to do what's best for her and free her from a life of grief and mourning for him. And at the end, it seems he cannot resist a terribly moving plea for her to remember him forever. She should be free to love another man and get married and live happily ever after, but he pleads, and the internal rhymes make it more poignant, but fair Margaret and rare Margaret and Margaret o' verity, gin ever ye love another man, now love him as ye did me. The border ballads like this one gain much of their strength from the drama they set up. Henry James pronounced that novelists should dramatize, dramatize, dramatize. No narrative voice interpreting what is going on, only the interaction between the characters, leaving us to interpret the motives and meanings as we do in real life. The Bible narratives do the same thing, and also, as I said, do these ballads. Now, here's another ballad, this one containing no action at all, only the drama of two voices speaking back and forth to each other. It's the ballad Edward, Edward, in which a Scottish nobleman or knight is confronted by his mother, who asks why his brand, that is his sword, is dripping blood. What has he just killed? And why is he so sad? Edward blithely answers that he's killed his hawk, Sigurd. And he's sad because he has no other hawk. But the mother knows better. Your hawk's blood was never so red. I'm not sure how she knows what shade of red the hawk's blood was, but she knows that's not what's made his sword so red. And she pushes him for a better answer. And he replies that he's just killed his red roan steed, that erst was safe, fair and free. Wait a minute, the mother says. Your steed was old and you got mare. You have more horses. This is no reason to go around looking so miserable. Some ither dool ye dree, she says, a great line, meaning some other grief you're suffering from. And finally he tells her the truth. I ha' killed my feyther dear. Alas, and wae is me, or woe is me, or even vae is meer. What's remarkable is that the mother does not start back in surprise or horror. She merely asks what penance he'll do for this murder. He tells her that he's going to get in that boat over there and go over the sea into exile. Next, she asks what he'll do with his towers and his hall that were so fair to see. Is she expecting him to leave her in charge? We don't know. And it seems he doesn't care, since he answers, I'll let them stand till they doon fall. And what will you leave to your bairns, your children, and your wife? And back comes the very harsh, very bitter reply, the world's room, let them beg through life, for them nevermare, nevermore will I see. This man is shattered, and can face nothing of his past life, not even the ones he loved best. And finally comes the question that's lain behind all the others. And what will you leave to your ain mother dear? And the answer? The curse of hell from me shall you bear, such counsels you gave to me. And that's the end of the poem. Well, what's going on here? What sort of drama have we stumbled upon? It's only at the last line that things become clear, a little anyway. Is this another version of Macbeth, with the mother playing the part of Lady Macbeth, urging Edward to murder his father? What kind of woman is she? Well, we get some sense of her mind when we see that she does not come straight out and ask him to confirm that he's done the deed that she has counseled him to do. Instead, she tortures him with questions that just rub in the pain he's feeling. Perhaps she enacts this fake drama of asking why his sword is so bloody as a kind of futile pretense that she's ignorant of what has been on his mind. And why did she counsel him to kill his father? Or did she counsel something else, which Edward then extended into murdering his father? What had the father done to provoke this? See, we know very little, but much is hinted at through the dramatic interplay between the two speakers. Listen again to C.R.M. Brooks, this time reading Edward, Edward, the version I knew as a teenager, the version that branded itself deep within my oral imagination, and now I hope upon yours too. Notice also the role played here by the repetition, Edward, Edward, and Mother, Mother, and the line endings punctuated by O.
Why does your brand say drop with blood, Edward, Edward? Why does your brand say drop with blood? And why say sad gang ye, O? Oh, I ha' killed my hawks again, mother, mother. Oh, I ha' killed my hawks again, and I had nae mare but he, O. Your hawk's blood was never so red, Edward, Edward. Your hawk's blood was never so red, my dear son, I tell ye, oh. Oh, I killed my reed-drawn steed, mother, mother. Oh, I killed my reed-drawn steed that erst was so fair and free, oh. Your steed was old and ye hae got mare, Edward. Edward, your steed was old and ye hae got mare. Some other dool ye dree, oh. Oh, I hae killed my feather dear, mother. Mother. Oh, I hae killed my feather dear. Alas, and wae is me, oh. And what in penance will ye dree for that, Edward? Edward. And what in penance will you dree for that, my dear son, who tell me, oh? I'll set my feet on yonder boat, mother, mother. I'll set my feet on yonder boat, and I'll fare o'er the sea, oh. And what will you do with your tours and your haw, Edward, Edward? And what will you do with your tours and your haw that were so fair to see, oh? I'll let them stand till they doon fa', mother. Mither, I'll let them stand till they doon fa', for here never mair man I be, oh. And what will you leave to your bairns and your wife, Edward? Edward, and what will you leave to your bairns and your wife when ye gang over the sea, oh? The world's room. Let them beg through life. Mither, mither, the world's room. Let them beg through life, for them never mair will I see, oh. And what will you leave to your ain mother dear, Edward? Edward, and what will you leave to your ain mother dear, my dear son, who tell me, oh? The curse of hell from me shall you bear, mother. Mother, the curse of hell from me shall you bear, sick counsels you gave to me, oh.
Brown a cool and speak the mist is sailing the banshee croons had a note of wailing but my
Well, we heard Edward, Edward, read by C.R.M. Brooks, followed by the wonderful Jeannie Robertson singing Macrimmon's Lament, a border ballad coupled with a Hebridean song, two distinct traditions. But I think the deep sorrow of Jeannie Robertson's voice, lamenting the death of Macrimmon, picks up the voice of the ballad, at least of Edward's voice, if not his mother's. And the voice you're hearing now is mine, Robert Louis Abrahamson, the voice of Evening Under Lamplight, coming to you each fortnight on Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city. We're talking about the way literature gains its strength through its dramatic qualities. I wanted to bring in a song that enacted a complex dramatic scene. Many songs feature a simple dramatic context, the singer addressing his or her lover in complaint or seduction, or celebration. But what about a more complex situation? The singer addressing one person and then another person, giving us a kind of three-dimensional scene being enacted before us. The song that came to mind is one of my favorite Dylan songs, though one that was released only on bootleg versions. She's Your Lover Now. Even the title presents this dramatic context. The speaker, the current lover, and the woman over there, the she. In other words, it's a drama involving some sort of love triangle. But it's an odd situation, which it can take some time to figure out. The setting seems to be in some bar, where he, the speaker, has encountered his former lover, who apparently had held on to him when she was no longer happy with him. "Why didn't you just leave me if you didn't want to stay?" he says to her now. To him, it seems like she just wanted to hang on to torment him. But she's gone now, on to a new lover, it seems. But now that she sees him again, she's coming on to him, asking him if he remembers things they used to do, even though, in his own eyes, he was always straight with her and didn't try to change her. She remembers it differently, or wants to play some game about how he hurt her. "Now you stand here saying you forgive and forget. Honey, what can I say?" She's playing at making up to him, even seducing him, but to him it's just more torment. And now here she is, with her finger going up his sleeve. What's going on? And isn't there a third party to this scene? The speaker keeps turning to this third party, her lover now, telling him to take control, or she's going to start acting really strange, as is her habit. She'll be standing on the bar soon, with a fish head and a harpoon and a fake beard plastered on her brow. You'd better do something quick. She's your lover now. The song is from the Blonde on Blonde era, and the tune has certain affinities to Sooner or Later One of Us Must Know. And so we're not too surprised at the cryptic opening lines, though we're a little shocked by the vehemence of the painful rage. Let's look at the first stanza in some detail. "The pawnbroker roared, also so did the landlord. The scene is so crazy, wasn't it? Both were so glad to watch me destroy what I had. Pain sure brings out the best in people, doesn't it?" You'll have to wait a second until I play the song to feel the force of that, "doesn't it?" Half sneering, half drawling sarcasm. But what's that doing here anyway? It's as if he's saying to her, "Thanks for giving me this pain. You brought out the best in me, right? Pain sure brings out the best in people, doesn't it?" "Yeah," she says, I guess it does." Thus agreeing that she just wanted to give him pain. No, wait a minute. Pain doesn't bring out the best in people, does it? No, it doesn't. Wait, where is she? Score one to Dylan for knocking her off her feet. Then there's a shift in rhythm and rhyme, with three long lines rhyming together. The first two lines throw out three perfectly reasonable questions to his former lover. "Why didn't you just leave me if you didn't want to stay? Why'd you have to treat me so bad? Did it have to be that way?" Again, what can she answer? And then the third rhyming line, a line so long it has to stumble over itself, starting with "now" and juggling with four verbs to build up to our first climax. "Now you stand here expecting me to remember something you forgot to say?" And he prolongs that final word until it takes up about as much time as the whole rest of the sentence. But before we can recover from this, he shifts ground again, changes the dramatic context, and turns to her lover now, just giving him a glance before dismissing his relevance to the scene. "Yes, and you, I see you're still with her. Well, that's fine, 'cause she's coming on so strange. Can't you tell?" As though he's saying, "Hey man, aren't you aware that she's standing here in your presence trying to come on to me somehow?" And another shift, as though he's looking around the room, looking for somebody to take some responsibility here. Somebody had better explain she's got her iron chain. Then his perfectly reasonable, innocent voice, I'd do it, but I just can't remember how. Yeah, he's forgotten how to explain to her. You see, she dumped me, and, well, I sort of forgot all those special ways you have to deal with a person like her. You know how it is. Perfectly reasonable. Are you off guard now? Good, because here comes the stinging refrain as he swings back to her lover now and throws it in his face. You talk to her. She's your lover now. And this is only the first round. There are at least two more to come. My desire is to go through all the verses with you so we can share them together. But my impulse is to lighten up a bit and spare you this. Hey, you got ears, right? Well, just listen to the song, and I'll listen to it with you. See if you can attend to the deft footwork in the other stanzas, the same pattern of moves, floating like a butterfly, stinging like a bee. The version we'll hear from the Bootleg Series 2 gets off to a slow start as the musicians gradually find their voices.
Your pawnbroker roared, also so did the landlord. They see me so crazy, wasn't me. Both were so glad to watch me destroy what I had. Pain sure brings out the best in people, doesn't it? Why didn't you just leave me if you didn't want to stay? Why'd you have to treat me so bad? Did it have to be that way? Now you stand here expecting me to remember something you forgot to say. Yes, and you, I see you're still with her. Well, that's fine, but she's coming on so strange, can't you tell? Somebody better explain. She's got her iron chain. I do it, but I just can't remember how. You talk to her. She's your lover now. Judge, you don't have to be nice to me. Will you please tell that to your friend in the cowboy hat? You know he keeps on saying everything twice to me. You know I was straight with you. You know I never tried to change you in any way. You know if you didn't want to be with me, that you didn't have to stay. Now you stand here saying you forgive and forget. Honey, what can I say? Yes, you just sit around and ask for ashtrays. Can't you reach? See, you kiss her on the cheek every time she gives a speech. Well, her picture books of the pyramid and her postcards of Billy the Kid. Must everybody bow? You better talk to her about it. You're her lover now. But I'm not up in the castle, honey. It's true, I just can't recall San Francisco at all. I can't. so hard for you if you didn't want to be with me just to
there. Which instrument fell out of line, or was it Dylan himself? He seems to have that final line wrong. At least it disagrees with the one other version we have with piano solo from the album Thin Wild Mercury. This is a slower version, less angry, more tired, more bluesy and nasal, more lyrical and even odder phrasing, and even more prolonged line endings. You can actually hear this version on YouTube if you haven't got the album. Here's how the final stanza proceeds in this version. Must I be in so sadness? Do I look like Charles Atlas? Do you think I still got what you still got, baby? My voice is really warm. It's just that it ain't got no form. It's like a dead man's last pistol shot, baby. Did you catch that rhyme? You still got, baby, and pistol shot, baby. Audaciously rhyming you still with pistol. Ah, your mouth used to be so naked. Your eyes used to be so blue. Your hurts used to be so nameless. Your tears used to be so few. And then the shift to the now line, you remember. And here's the line where the song fell apart in the other version. It's a shame because it's such an amazing line. In the other version, he said, your mouth cries wolf. But here it goes, now your eyes cry wolf, while your mouth cries, I'm not scared of animals like you. Let me say that again. We could spend the whole night on this line. Now your eyes cry wolf, while your mouth cries, I'm not scared of animals like you. Her mouth cries that she's not scared of animals like you, but this is just a bluff. Her eyes, the true part of her, are crying wolf, crying out for help. Is she really desperate for help? Or are her eyes only crying wolf, just going through the motions? What exactly does she feel? What kind of game is she playing? She, whose mouth used to be so naked and whose eyes used to be so blue. Nope, this is drama, and we get only the words and have to work out the motivation behind the words for ourselves. And the shift to the other guy with the expected put-down, and you, there's really nothing about you I can recall. I just saw you there one time, and you were just there, that's all. Then his step backwards, refusing to be pulled into this game with the woman again. But I've already been kissed. I'm not going to get into this. I couldn't make it anyhow. And the refrain, you do it for me. You're her lover now. You can see, can't you, the way the real strength of this song comes from the voice in its dramatic context, as it pivots between the woman and her lover now, playing with the structure of the meter in rhyme and with the backup instruments too. But then remember, it all breaks down at the end. Dylan gets the words wrong and the other instruments come to a halt. What? Asks Dylan, and the bass hits three notes and all stops. This turns out to be fortuitous, since Whitman, in our passage this week, also seems to come to a stop. Yes, let's shift now to Walt Whitman. Hang on. Well, here we are with Whitman. All his bluster and confidence that we've seen throughout the whole poem suddenly turns, and for a moment we hear a new voice, a voice of uncertainty. He does not know what it is in him, except to say that he knows it's in him. It's beyond words, beyond voice. I do not know it. It is without name. It is a word unsaid. But if he enters into a meditative state, calm and cool, I sleep long. If he silences himself like this, he is certain that this whatever it is, we might call it God, but that's just another word, is at the heart of the universe and is friendly towards him. In fact, it embraces him, which is a way to say that he perceives this something all around him, pervading him. And this embrace wakes him again, and now, waking from that meditative state, he can find some words to describe this thing in him. It is not chaos or death. That is, it's not random or life-denying. It is form, he suggests. It has a shape. It is not random. And it's union, tying everything together. And it's plan, tying everything together into a coherent design that has a purpose. And he concludes finally that it is eternal life. It is happiness. There's an interesting moment of dramatic intensity just before these final lines, as he turns to us, the readers, sort of grabbing our lapel, pulling us over so we can perceive what he has perceived. "Do you see, O my brothers and sisters?" he exclaims. It's not enough just to proclaim his vision. He has to make it dramatic, as Robert Frost would have told him to do, and proclaims the vision directly to us. But let's make room for Whitman's voice coming to us through this whole short passage, chant 50 of Song of Myself. There is that in me, I do not know what it is, but I know it is in me. Wrenched and sweaty, calm and cool, then my body becomes. I sleep long. I do not know it. It is without name. It is a word unsaid. It is not in any dictionary or utterance or symbol. Something it swings on more than the earth I swing on. To it the creation is the friend whose embracing awakes me. Perhaps I might tell more. Outlines, I plead for my brothers and sisters. Do you see, O my brothers and sisters? It is not chaos or death. It is form and union and plan. It is eternal life. It is happiness. This is Elgar's Jupiter, bringer of jollity, and you've been listening to Evening Under Lamplight with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, here on Cambridge 105. Catch me at RLA at momentsunderlamplight.co.uk or lamplight at cambridge105.fm, and come back again in a fortnight for our next show. But for now, oh brothers and sisters, good night.